Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today will stay sunny and warm, looking for a high temperature of 101. Then clear skies tonight, lows around 75. Sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 103. Currently with relative humidity at just 8%, it's sunny and 97 degrees. In Valley traffic, accidents on the 202 westbound at 24th Street, and there's also a collision blocking the shoulder, I-10 westbound at Ray Road. The Supreme Court has ruled federal courts must recognize tribal convictions when determining if a domestic violence offender should legally be considered habitual. KJZZ's Carrie Young reports repeated convictions for domestic violence can lead to stiffer prison sentences.
The ruling settles a legal challenge against a section of the Violence Against Women Act that included tribal court convictions in its definition of habitual. The High Court ruled in the case of Michael Bryant Jr., who received a 46-month federal prison term after pleading guilty to assaulting two women on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in Montana. Bryant's attorney argued the use of tribal convictions violated his Sixth Amendment rights because tribal courts don't guarantee defendants an attorney, and Bryant's previous convictions on the reservation were handled without a lawyer. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg delivered the opinion. She says the decision was based on the fact the Sixth Amendment does not govern tribal court proceedings. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona's 2014 election cycle included a lot of allegations related to dark money spending in several races, including the competition to be on the Arizona Corporation Commission. And now, in June of 2016, we've come to find out the FBI has launched a probe into 2014. Investigators have started with former Commissioner Gary Pierce. With me to give us some details is Luigi Del Puerto of the Arizona Capital Times. So, Luigi, what did they say to Gary Pierce?
Two FBI agents had knocked on his door at his home. His home is also where his office is at, and wanted to talk to him about the 2014 elections. Gary Pierce wouldn't say wouldn't divulge a lot of details, except that the agents wanted to talk to him, as I mentioned, about the 2014 elections. He said they're trying, and this is him speaking, he said, and I quote, "They're trying to arrive at the truth." And Pierce told me that he cooperated with the investigators who had asked him not to relay a whole lot of information about that meeting.
Gary Pierce's son, Justin, ran for Secretary of State a couple of years ago, and there were some things that popped up there. Is this potentially related to that?
The answer is we don't know exactly what the FBI is investigating. What we know is that what Gary Pierce has told us, which is that it's related somewhat to the elections in 2014. Now, you are right. There were a couple of issues that were raised during that race, and one of them was made against Justin Pierce by his opponent. If you recall, Justin Pierce was running as Secretary of State that year, and one of his Republican opponents was Will Cardin. And Will Cardin essentially accused Gary Pierce of using his influence on the Corporation Commission to help his son, Justin. In fact, I remember specifically a mailer that Will Cardin's campaign had sent out, and it had it was in the style of the wanted posters in the old West, and it had the for sale sign, and with the pictures of Gary Pierce and Justin Pierce, and then it says that and I quote from that mailer, it says his campaign, meaning Justin's campaign for Secretary of State, is being secretly financed by APS.
Well, I'm glad you brought up APS because, of course, there was so much controversy related to APS in 2014. There hasn't been anything ever confirmed that APS did give money to specific campaigns or not. Did you get a chance to talk with anybody at APS, and what did they have to say?
Yes, I did on Friday as well, and they said a short statement. They said that the U.S. Attorney's Office had been in contact with APS, and that's all they were going to say about it.
How big a deal does this feel like to you, this idea that the FBI would step into this, whether anyone is guilty of anything or not?
it is a big deal. Whenever you have FBI agents knocking at your door, it never is a good thing. And politically, it's a big deal. And like I mentioned, I keep mentioning this one because it's important to know. We don't know what they're investigating. We have no idea what they're after. What we know is that it's about the 2014 elections, and it is a big deal. It is surprising in a sense, but also I'd like to add that we don't know a whole lot about it yet.
Luigi Del Puerto of the Arizona Capital Times on the FBI's investigation of Arizona's 2014 election. University of Arizona President Ann Weaver Hart has decided she won't seek a contract extension. Her current pact expires in 2018. Hart was the focus of controversy in recent months for her decision to become a paid board member at for-profit DeVry University while maintaining the U of A presidency. With me to talk about Hart's decision and what's next is Jay Heiler, chair of the Arizona Board of Regents. Jay, how long has this been in the works?
We had been discussing this for the past month and a half to 2 months, Steve, of whether or not she might decide to move on to her next phase. She will be 70 years old when this contract completes, and she had called me and pointed that out and let me know that she was considering making plans to move into her next phase and to return to the faculty at the university. So no, it was not a surprise. It was something we had been discussing for some weeks.
And I think most of our listeners know about the controversy that was generated that she was serving on the board of DeVry, a for-profit school. Jay, was that something that that you found troublesome, other members of the Board of Regents found troublesome, and is this in some ways a relief that she's decided to move on?
My approach to that was simply to make sure that our policies were followed, Steve, and leave that decision to President Hart. She followed the policies. I, in turn, engaged with our general counsel to make sure that the necessary disclosures under our policies were made, and we proceeded. So I think that serving on boards is something that many university presidents look forward to doing, and they might do more of it when they finish their time in office than they did before. So I don't think that was really a large factor here. It might properly be perceived as a sign that President Hart was already beginning to think about her next phase and her career after the conclusion of this contract.
You mentioned the word perceive. Perception's a big thing. You've been involved in politics and media for a long time. And I wonder if when you start hearing lawmakers saying this person should resign, doesn't it just help the university system in general to have that no longer be an albatross?
Well, the university system's going to be well served by President Hart continuing to lead U of A through the contract she's currently under, because it gives us a continuation of the work that's already begun there, and it also gives us the opportunity to really think clearly about who the next leader should be and then have the time to go and find that leader. So the way that President Hart has gone about this is beneficial for herself and for the University of Arizona. And we will take some time as we go through the summer and into the fall to design and consider our search process. Then we will begin it later in the year.
Is there the idea out there that there are some other challenges, though, with this university system, considering state budgets and whatnot? It's not unique in Arizona, but certainly it's gotten a lot of attention here. Does that in any way make it harder to attract people, or do you think you're going to get the best of the best?
Our university system has been faced with significant financial challenge due to the fiscal environment that the state has been in. And we have just now, after several years of effort, begun moving that needle back in the other direction, which we're very intent on maintaining. And I think the prospects regarding what happens in the future are more important, to your point and your question, than what happened in the past. Many state university systems have suffered fiscal shrinkage and budget shrinkage in the past few years. What we're trying to do is establish a funding model going forward in Arizona that allows our fine state universities to rely on a stable source of funding and contribution from the state that is directed at educating in-state students for whom the state bears a constitutional obligation.
Jay Heiler is chair of the Arizona Board of Regents. Jay, thanks for the time.
Thank you, Steve. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, sir.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening today. Along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick, I'm Steve Goldstein. How is the rest of the world responding to yet another mass shooting on American soil? Rukmini Kalamaki is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, and she joins us from Paris. Paris, of course, has been under siege by terrorism over the last year, with attacks in restaurants and bars and a concert stadium in November of last year, and the attacks on the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine in 2015.
Jessica Stern is a terrorism expert and author of ISIS, The State of Terror. She joins us from Bergen, Norway, where the trauma is still felt from a mass shooting that killed 77 people back in 2011. Rukmini and Jessica, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Rukmini Kalamaki, let me start with you. This attack is similar in some ways to the Paris attack at the concert that we saw last year. People out having a good time. What's been the reaction there?
The reaction has been somewhat muted, and I think that's because in Paris right now, they have so many of their own problems. They're dealing with the Euro 2016, which is a major soccer competition. And one of the interrogations that was done after the November Paris attacks with one of the suspects indicated that the Euro 2016 was going to be an ISIS target. So law enforcement here is really out in force.
Jessica Stern, let's talk about the possible ties to Islamic State on the part of the assailant, such as those ties are. What's the value of a lone wolf attack, if indeed that's what this is? There's no evidence yet that the attacker had any real contact with planners from the Islamic State. But the attacker at least publicized ISIS with a 911 call before it began. Is that in itself valuable to ISIS?
Yes. ISIS has been taking credit for lone actor attacks, even when, as far as we know, there hasn't been any kind of direction at all. Perhaps there was direction, we don't yet know, but the fact that they claim credit doesn't indicate that there was. It indicates nothing.
Rukmini Kalamaki, what does that credit look like on social media right now, even in retrospect, if Islamic State is trying to take credit for the attack or trump it up on social media? What does that look like?
We're seeing the usual backslapping and celebration by Islamic State members on Telegram and on social media. Last night, I saw a number of them changing their profile picture to the photograph of the attacker, the one of him taking a selfie in the mirror. And a lot of them are also posting the message of Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, the group's spokesman. He came out with his annual pre-Ramadan message a couple of weeks ago. And in that message, just as he did the year before and the year before that, he called on attackers and specifically on their adherents in the West, including in America, to carry out attacks on their own in any way they could in order to hurt the so-called infidels.
Is there any indication that Islamic State has wanted to inspire homophobic attacks in particular? I mean, certainly they are a grimly homophobic organization. There's no question about that. Has there ever been rhetoric from people like the spokesman that you mentioned to say this is a group of Western decadence that we want to target?
I certainly haven't seen that. Obviously, for somebody who had homophobic tendencies, as this young man did, we've seen the reporting citing various friends of his who saw him grimacing when he saw two men kissing on a beach in Florida. For somebody like that, you could see how this group would be appealing. This is a group that has been throwing homosexuals off of buildings in Syria and in Iraq as a way to punish them. As far as actually targeting them as a group that merits to be killed in the West, I've not seen evidence of that.
Jessica, that indicates, and again, we're in an area of speculation inevitably here, but if what Rukmini is saying is the case so far, it would appear that this was a deranged or homophobic person who found an ideology that he could retrofit into his aggression and animosity that he already had.
That's actually what we often see with lone actor terrorists. They often have mixed motives. They have personal motives. And then they have a political agenda that can be almost a gloss. They've often engaged in previous acts of violence. They're often so socially isolated. We see a lot more mental illness among lone actors. And apparently this young man had been violent against his wife. That would be something not uncommon among lone actors. religious terrorists can find justification for acting out their own personal pain. And sometimes they adopt the religious ideology very soon before the attack.
Rukmini Kalamaki, this is a country where people can get assault rifles, but there is the practical implication of that fact and a new era of franchise terrorism.
Yeah, I would add that this case is more troubling than the other lone wolf actors that we've seen. For instance, with the San Bernardino couple that carried out the mass shooting at a community center last December, there really was no immediate tie that was found to the Islamic State in terms of their communications, as far as we know. With this young man, we have something that's in the middle. In 2013, the FBI had put him under surveillance because of his extremist ideology. In 2014, they discovered communications between him and the first American suicide bomber. This is a young man also from Florida who went and joined the Nusra Front, the group that was the precursor to the Islamic State. So there are some fingerprints that are in the ether here that you would think that authorities might have been able to grab onto.
And Jessica Stern, what do those fingerprints say to you as an expert and an analyst? If he hasn't done anything illegal but has talked to the wrong people, it makes it hard to neutralize him, get him out of the way before a crime is committed.
It's very hard for law enforcement authorities to get this right. On the one hand, people are very concerned that they're spying, that they're monitoring people inappropriately, and yet at the same time, this man, obviously, and others have fallen through the cracks. Just because he spoke with someone, just because he has certain ideas, that's not considered necessarily a problem. But what we do know about lone actor terrorists is that they often talk about violence in advance. It's not just their thinking, it's their plans. They often share their plans. They often talk about violence. They talk about hatred. This is really important because people who know individuals, perpetrators, often know something in advance, and they can go to authorities.
And Jessica Stern, your final thoughts as the country once again grapples with the existential and practical effects of this attack?
I think practically, at a minimum, we ought to make it impossible for those on a terrorist watch list to buy guns. That seems like a very practical thing that could be done right now. Spiritually, I think we will be seeing attacks like this, and it's very important that people always remember that terrorism is political theater, and the whole point is to make us afraid, to terrify us, and get us to overreact. And we should just bear that in mind as we go forward.
Jessica Stern is author of ISIS, The State of Terror. She joined us from Bergen in Norway. Rukmini Kalamaki, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, from Paris. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. The words echo throughout our society. Whether you're an attorney, a criminal, or simply someone who enjoys TV police dramas, you have the right to remain silent. That influential phrase became cemented in the American consciousness thanks to a U.S. Supreme Court decision 50 years ago today, Miranda versus Arizona. The case that led to that decision had its humble beginnings in Phoenix when two legendary attorneys took on accused rapist Ernesto Miranda as a client. Miranda was a produce worker for Mesa. He became the prime suspect in a series of crimes in 1963, including rape. Miranda was interrogated by the Phoenix Police Department and confessed, which led to him going to prison. He was sentenced to serve 20 years, but the case caught the attention of the American Civil Liberties Union, which believed the poor and uneducated were not being told about their constitutional rights. That led to two Phoenix attorneys, the late John Flynn and John Frank, petitioning the Supreme Court, which accepted the case and heard Miranda versus Arizona in February of 1966. Frank was a legendary constitutional lawyer, while Flynn was considered a courtroom master. It was Flynn who argued on Miranda's behalf before the High Court.
That he had the right not to incriminate himself, that he had a right not to make any statement, that he had the right to be free from further questioning by the police department, that he had the right at an ultimate time to be represented adequately by counsel in court.
The late Gary Nelson, then an assistant attorney general in Arizona, argued the state's case. He said police officers wouldn't be able to do their jobs if the law required that suspects were immediately entitled to attorneys.
When counsel is introduced at interrogation, interrogation ceases.
I thought we had done everything and that there was no question that Miranda knew what he was doing and that we'd given him almost all of the warnings that people were advocating, and there was really no external evidence of coercion of any sort.
On June 13, 1966, a 5-4 majority of the court reversed Miranda's rape conviction, making his name synonymous with suspects' rights. But the High Court's decision was not retroactive and didn't free Miranda. He remained in the Florence prison, becoming a celebrity to his fellow inmates. The late Peter Baird worked with John Frank and John Flynn and began to handle Miranda's representation.
What I found so interesting about him is I had to get information about the other crime and the circumstances relating to the confession to that other crime. And I'll never forget when I talked to him in Florence, I asked him about that other confession, and he said, "I don't confess. Didn't you know that?" And I thought that was hilarious because, of course, he had confessed. But around the prison, he had a reputation. He became a celebrity overnight. I guess the prison inmates understood the impact of this. Ernie never confesses, and so that made him a real celebrity.
Miranda cashed in on his famous name after he left prison in March of 1975. He autographed Miranda warning cards and added the date of the Supreme Court decision, and he sold them for a few dollars apiece. But a poker game on January the 31st of 1976 in downtown Phoenix went awry, and Miranda was stabbed to death. Though Ernesto Miranda's name is attached to the 50-year-old decision, the Supreme Court's 5-4 ruling and the work of his legal team are at the heart of the case's legacy. Miranda's late lawyer John Frank summed it up this way.
What was important about Miranda is that it said that confessions had to be voluntary and that people were entitled to counsel and didn't have to... They could stand on their constitutional rights. A lot of people don't know they have constitutional rights, and after Miranda now, they all do.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein, joined now by Phil Latzman. And while most Arizona public school students are out on summer break, public school districts around the state are busy looking to fill teacher vacancies for the upcoming year.
And Steve, now that Prop 123 has passed at the ballot box and cleared all legal hurdles, there's more money available in that pool of funds.
And districts around the state are receiving an additional $224 million for this fiscal year. They'll get another $230 million for the next fiscal year that begins July 1st. And this past week, Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich cleared the way for Prop 123 money to begin flowing into schools.
His office ruled that the state's Board of Investment did not face legal liability for tapping the state's land trust for a total of $3.5 billion that will be added to schools' budgets over the next 10 years. That figure may sound like a lot, but it's just a start. The Arizona School Boards Association represents all of the state's 224 school districts. Its executive director, Tim Ogle, believes the new money will make a difference, but more will be needed to make a real impact.
Our members, for the most part, have, you know, went ahead and adopted two budgets. One is if Prop 123 failed, and of course, the better budget as if Prop 123 had passed. And so now they just have to hold a quick budget adoption meeting and then implement the new budget with a couple extra pennies in it.
Yeah, is it more than a couple extra pennies? I mean, that sort of devalues it a little bit, but is it enough to make a difference?
It is enough to make a difference, and our teachers deserve to be paid more. Certainly, this is just a first step. We'll continue to advocate for better pay and benefits for our teaching faculty. And as you know, we have a teacher crisis in our state, and we have people fleeing the profession, and we need best, smartest people working with our children.
Last year at this time, I had spoken to you guys about the teacher shortages in Arizona. Now that Prop 123 has passed, does that mean that you can start filling some of those vacancies, and will things improve as far as getting teachers to come here?
We hope things will improve. You know, in working with our university friends, we know that the pipeline for teachers, for the profession is very, very small right now, and it's because of the way we've treated our professional teachers. So we hope this is a first step to make things better.
How can you at the School Board Association assure
or ensure that the money is being used in the right way to hire teachers and being used in classrooms?
That's a great question, and it has also a very positive answer, and that is that school districts are represented by elected officials that are accountable to the voters. And being publicly elected officials, they're subject to all of the expectations of transparency and open records, and they are public servants, and they assume those school leadership seats because they care about teaching and learning and our children. Our districts are subject to all of the financial accountability regulations, actually more so than almost any other government agency.
As we've talked about, it's not a ton of money, but it is enough to make a difference. But I thought in reading this that it only brings Arizona up in the amount of money that it spends on education, really up to maybe 45 from where it was before, which was perhaps a couple of slots lower. What has to be done, in your opinion, to continue moving Arizona up those rankings, and how soon does that need to happen?
Thank you for that question, and your train of thought is absolutely correct. This was never intended to move the needle relative to the 49 other states. This was Prop 123 was the resolution to a lawsuit, and the lawsuit had to do with funding schools at the rate of inflation. So we checked that box. Now the heavy lifting starts, and in working with all kinds of folks across the political spectrum and the agency spectrum and with our association partners in the school business, everyone is committed to take this momentum and these partnerships that have formed to continue to elevate the discussion about how important K-12 district schools are to the economy and the backbone of our state. And so this is the mark in time. And now we move on past Prop 123 to talk about serious financial reform.
Timothy Ogle is Executive Director of the Arizona School Boards Association. Tim, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, Phil. Anytime.
In other news from KJZZ, did the Saudi hijackers who flew planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon get any help from the Saudi government? It's a question that lingers nearly 15 years after the attacks, which killed nearly 3,000 people. And once again, it's getting headlines, this time backed by new legislation that's adding to turbulent times between the historic allies. The BBC's Barbara Platt-Usher reports.
I got ghosts here. I had 3,000 people die where we're standing and in Washington and Pennsylvania.
Jerry Goldman is a lawyer who's tried to sue the Saudi government for alleged involvement in the 9/11 attacks. He's meeting me here at the memorial pools where the towers used to stand.
And where we've been stopped right now has been the ability to use the courts to establish what happened. Let us go into court and we'll put forward our proof.
This issue of possible Saudi support for the hijackers has festered for years. But now a bill is working its way through Congress that would make it easier to test that in court. That's good news for Kathy Owens. She's joined me here next to the names etched in the granite. One is that of her husband, Peter Owens.
You know, you can't imagine not really knowing what happened and that we're possibly allies and friends with someone who had a hand in all those murders. And I want that resolved.
A bill to deter terrorism, provide justice for victims, and for other purposes.
So does the U.S. Senate, defying the White House, which strongly opposes the bill because it lifts the sovereign immunity that protects foreign governments from lawsuits.
The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it.
Now the legislation moves to the House of Representatives. Congress is also putting pressure on the Obama administration to release classified documents from the 9/11 investigation related to a possible Saudi role. Tim Romer was a member of the commission.
Did not discover that there was direct high-level Saudi government involvement in the actual plot of 9/11. However, we found that Saudi Arabia was a fertile ground for fundraising for al-Qaeda, and we found that there was a real proclivity to export extremism and intolerance. Those issues are very much alive today.
Why do you think this is picking up now? I mean, has the relationship become less sacred?
We think they should be doing more on counterterrorism. More cooperation from the Saudis could actually help us achieve our strategic objectives in an area that's in flames.
In fact, the Saudis are eager to show off how much they are cooperating on counterterrorism, as I discovered during a visit last year.
Okay, they go to the next building. They go inside the building.
They organized this demonstration by their special forces troops, trained by the U.S. And they've just released an unusually detailed memo laying out steps taken to fight militants, control terrorist financing, and stop radicalization. The Saudis deny any involvement in the 9/11 attacks, although they are angry about how this latest push is affecting their reputation. But there's more to it than that.
I mean, I was in the Pentagon on 9/11. I lost 85 teammates, attended something close to 60 funerals.
Even so, General Jack Keane doesn't support the bill. He's a defense analyst who served as an Army Vice Chief of Staff, and he's concerned about the general state of relations.
All of those numerous policy disagreements that Saudi Arabia has had with the United States, and the largest one of all is the United States' strategic withdrawal in the Middle East.
The strategic relationship has anchored U.S. Mideast policy since the Second World War, cemented by oil and arms sales. President Obama got a fittingly regal welcome when he visited Riyadh 2 years ago.
Everybody ready?
But by the time King Salman came to Washington last September, the strain was showing.
It's a great pleasure to welcome His Majesty King Salman.
Despite the welcoming words, Mr. Obama has rattled the alliance by walking away from the old order that's underpinned the modern Middle East. He's reached out to Saudi Arabia's bitter enemy, Iran, and taken a more hands-off approach to the region. The kingdom is worried, says Saudi expert Karen Elliott House.
The number one question they wanted to ask is the U.S. policy of avoiding involvement in Middle East problems permanent, or will a new U.S. president again exert traditional leadership in the Middle East, including support for our Saudi ally?
Good question.
We protect Saudi Arabia. We protect them for peanuts. And, you know, if we weren't protecting them, they wouldn't be there for a week.
The Saudis are wary about Donald Trump. They don't know what to make of the pronouncements he comes up with in his interviews.
Come out and vote and bring everybody you can.
Hillary Clinton would almost certainly be a better fit, a more sympathetic and predictable option than Mr. Trump, and possibly Mr. Obama. Either way, the relationship isn't going to break. It's too important. But it is in flux, and reopening the 9/11 controversy could deepen mutual mistrust at a time of uncertainty.
The BBC's Barbara Plett Usher reporting. Being a spokesman for a law enforcement agency means you're the one most often identified with anything that department does, good or bad. That's been Sergeant Trent Crump's job with the Phoenix Police Department for more than 8 years. He's been with the department for a total of 30. Sergeant Crump hangs up his badge for good this week as he retires from the force, and he joins me now to talk about policing and his career. Trent, how open do you think you should be when the media have asked you questions? And what's your perspective on how body cameras fit into the idea of more information coming out?
Well, I don't know that that's the police department's decision to make. And the reason that I say that is because there's, you know, to me, there's both sides. And I'll take it to the body camera issue simply because you're using that as an example mm-hmm. here. But I believe that one of our key roles in this as the police department when we're investigating crimes is to protect the victims. It's to protect the witnesses. It's to protect suspects pre-arrest. In cases as well. And so there's a constitution to uphold, and there's victims' rights, there's juvenile rights. And so you look at all of these things and you understand that there's a balance between the public's desire to know, the need to know, those things that some may want to know, but is it affecting these other people? As the victim of a crime, when you call the police, is it your intention that we bring the media with us? And that everything that we gather at your crime, whatever it might be, whether it's at your private residence, whether it's an intimate crime that occurred to you. I tell reporters all the time, if you want to tell a better story about what happened, please go to the scene and look at it so that you can describe in detail what you see that are the soft sides of an issue that you believe readers will want to see or hear in your story. It's hard for me to tell those in words. When I go on scene and there is camera footage available, whether it's an on-officer camera, surveillance camera, cell phone footage, I would prefer to see that prior to talking about an event, because it gives me a better idea of how to describe or how to relay that information publicly.
Trent, how important has it been for you to work with various chiefs? Have certain chiefs wanted you to approach this a certain way? Have they been mostly hands-off? How's that worked?
When I tell people that, I've never had anybody tell me what to say. I don't know that some of them believe me. And I've had some people say, why don't you not say that again? So that's happened a couple of times. But the privilege of working for three different chiefs as a spokesperson, about six different chiefs total over the past 30 years, you get a lot of different perspective. And I have to tell you that from the day that Chief Jack Harris brought me into the job as the spokesperson for the agency, it was very clear. The issue was tell the truth. It's very simple. Mm-hmm. When we go in front of people, here's what we do.
To what extent is it becoming more dangerous to be a police officer in general?
You know, I like to try to back information up statistically, just from what I have had to do, because I realize that a lot of times people will say, wow, there's been a rash of police shootings. Oh, there's been a rash of homicides. And then I go back and I look at the data over the past 5 years or the past 10 years, and I look at it and I go, well, you know, and it seems like it. And the frequency over the past 3 or 4 months has been high. But in all reality, we're where we were at the same time last year and the year before on a count or a number. And so I'm not prepared to tell you specifically acts of violence against police officers, tell you that it is more dangerous. I can tell you that I think that we've had the frequency of incidents against police officers here with this in the last few months with several officer-involved shootings. But we were at an all-time low prior to that. And so you look at that and go, are there more, or are we covering police issues more now? Are they more prevalent in the media?
How did you feel when your son decided that he wanted to get involved in this too?
Probably apprehensive in the beginning, thinking he doesn't have the ability, he can't do this, right, after being in it for so long. Then after watching him in it and listening to the others on the police department talk about his quality, his performance at work and his abilities, I became comfortable with it. I think my biggest level of fear, if you will, the uncomfortable, is the public trust. I think the public trust in the police is crucial, and I think that we need to have it, and I think that we do here in Phoenix. But it is one of those things that I think is the most crucial. You know, you can talk about safety. There's a lot of that in an officer's own tactics and what they do and how safely they drive and wearing a vest and wearing a seatbelt and all those things that you can do. The public trust is something that we have to continue to garnish out here so that the police officers believe, the police officer is assisted. Our goal is to reduce all of these other crimes. If we're having several hundred homicides and several thousand robberies, and aggravated assaults, let's not have the focus be a camera on a police officer. Let's solve these thousands of crimes that are occurring so that everybody is safer.
Phoenix Police Sergeant Trent Crump, retiring after nearly a decade as the spokesman and about 30 years with the department. Trent, thank you for coming in.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Construction started on a new mixed-use building in downtown Gilbert last week called Building 313. It's owned by Lynn King Smith, who is looking to create a new space for her company, Ticketforce, an online ticketing management company. So she teamed up with Lorraine Bergman, owner of Caliente Construction, to build it. Then she realized how rare it is for a project like this to be spearheaded by two women, and the building turned into something bigger.
That's what this building is becoming, is a very visible, tangible thing that other women can see what Lorraine and I are doing in that space, and hopefully be encouraged to not have boundaries that they maybe think they have based on what their field or what their perceived limitations are. So that's really what we're hoping the building becomes.
She added another floor to the original plans for a co-working space for women and expects the building to be finished in 2017. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger joins us with more on this idea of women-focused workplaces. Lauren?
Hi. So I spoke with Krista Brookman about this. She's the vice president of the Inclusive Leadership Initiative at Catalyst. That's a nonprofit based in New York that aims to help women move forward by building inclusive workplaces. Brookman says to build those kind of workplaces, you have to remove the barriers women face in workplace culture, like stereotypes about their personalities.
And these are typically extreme perceptions about women, that women are either too tough, they're too soft, but they're never just right. So when women are labeled as to this or to that, it really makes it difficult to, you know, really achieve and be inclusive about all these different traits that your talent pool is bringing to your workplace. The other one that I would bring up in this conversation is, you know, visible role models. So when we see women in the executive ranks, when we see women as on corporate boards, that becomes something even more real than it may have not been if we just see white males there. So we, you know, our research continues to show the underrepresentation of women in these senior leadership ranks. Just a paltry 4% of the S&P 500 company CEO positions are held by women. Only about 19.2% of the S&P 500 companies' boards have women represented on them.
Yeah. So what do you think that a culture of inclusion and equality in the workplace looks like?
When organizations, you know, decide to close these gaps in opportunity, the gaps in pay, the gaps in advancement, I think it'll be a real game changer overall. And organizations that are able to foster inclusive workplaces are able to be more competitive because they are understanding and appreciative of the differences that everyone can bring and can leverage those to their strategic advantage.
When we look at these new sort of trendy co-working spaces, we have a lot of these popping up in Phoenix right now. Do you think that just the fact that spaces like this and office spaces like this are thinking about the workplace in a new way can be a good thing for women in the workplace?
So I think that these workspaces that are co-working and open provide us opportunities. It's an opportunity for us to think about shaping what we traditionally call a workplace in a new way. And that's all about disrupting the default. It's changing the status quo. And when we think about what an open workplace and a workspace can invite, we think about things like collaboration. We think about things like being inclusive. I grew up in a traditional office space where there were walls and the outer perimeter were reserved for the mucky mucks, and, you know, the inside perimeter was everyone else, the cube farm. And, you know, so many of those doors were closed. And I think that if you have an open, inviting office space, it does create a place where everyone feels that they belong, that everyone feels like they have a voice and they are recognized for what they can contribute to the organization.
Well, Krista Brookman, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
That was KJZZ's Lauren Gilger speaking with Krista Brookman, Vice President of the Inclusive Leadership Initiative at Catalyst. Lauren, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
You've no doubt heard of the biggest canyon in Arizona. The canyon part of the name is preceded by Grand, but the state's second biggest is less known. Sycamore Canyon was designated a wilderness area in 1972 and has expanded to more than 50,000 acres. Sycamore Canyon is featured prominently in the June issue of Arizona Highways, and editor Robert Steve joins me to talk about it. Robert, the magazine has covered Sycamore in the past. Why go back to it now?
It's a place that's relatively undiscovered, and it's the second largest canyon in our state after the very famous canyon to the north. And so it's this very massive place that has this great diversity. The canyon basically runs from sort of a riparian area down near Cottonwood up to the forests of Williams. So it's a big canyon that we thought a lot of people didn't know a lot about.
You know, there were three hikes highlighted. I think two of the hikes were listed as moderate. One was easy. I was surprised there wasn't just one of these. You're going to take out 5 days and better bring a lot of GORP and everything else. So.
There are about 15 or 18, maybe 20 designated trails in there. It's a wilderness area, so that sort of changes how things get taken care of. Because with wilderness areas, you're not allowed to take any mechanized equipment in. The longer ones that you refer to aren't as well maintained. Of course, at the magazine, we try to appeal to the broadest range of people that we can. However, that said, there are some great backpacking opportunities in this canyon.
So how many of the trails have you hit yourself?
Well, that's a great question. I was just looking at it. I've hit about 14 of them so far. Hopefully, I'll cross them all off before I'm done.
Are there one or two that you've done yourself at Sycamore that really illustrate the diversity we're talking about in terms of the different sorts of things you're going to see on a hike like this?
There are two. That's a good question. There's one in particular that a lot of people tend to find. It's down near Cottonwood. It's called the Parsons Spring Trail. And although Sycamore Creek runs the length of this canyon, which is, I think, more than 20 miles long, and at some points it's 7 miles wide, so it is big. And Sycamore Creek runs through it, but it doesn't have year-round water. However, the last about 5 miles do because it's fed by Parsons Springs. So it's accessible. You need a high-clearance vehicle to get to it, but that's one of the most beautiful trails in our entire state, frankly. I mean, the water's perennial. The cottonwood trees and sycamore trees just lend this great canopy when you're hiking down there. On the other end, there's something called the Sycamore Rim Trail, which you access from up by Williams. And what's great about that one, Steve, is that it really gives you sort of the higher viewpoint. A lot of the trails go actually down into the canyon. The Sycamore Rim Trail, as the name suggests, is up above. So you get to look down into this canyon and just get a sense of just how big it is.
How about seasonally, Robert? Is there a time that these trails are just magnificent even beyond belief?
Well, you're hitting all the good questions, because one of the great things about Sycamore is that it is a year-round opportunity. The north end can get snowy in the winter, but it's not like, you know, you think about snow in Flagstaff or in the White Mountains. The Parsons Trail on the southern end is a great fall hike, and it's actually fall in sort of November more than October, September, which is what people typically think of. So you've got your four seasons in there, but they're more moderate than other parts of the state, so it is a great opportunity to explore at any time.
Let's come back to the piece on Sycamore Canyon, which includes a story from 1958, mm-hmm. So 58 years ago, and there's a real quaintness to it,
right.
And the way it was written. Why did you want to include it?
This one does stand the test of time for me, because this canyon, frankly, hasn't really changed very much. It's gained some wilderness protection since it was first written. But the description of the area and sort of the mystique of this canyon, and the writer of that piece lived in Sedona, which is not far from Sycamore Canyon. And as he writes this piece, he talks about just like this great, it's sort of like the lost city of Atlantis being just up the street. And it's like, well, we're finally going to go check it out. And so it was just a great story. And being a writer, too, I think I love the way, you know, you mentioned a quaintness to it, and there's something simpler about the writing style from some of those old pieces and some of the word choices, and the language is just different.
Robert Steve, he's the editor of Arizona Highways. We've been talking about one of the feature pieces in the June issue about Sycamore Canyon. Robert, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Today we continue our celebration of the working life. We're looking at the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. We're thinking about the jobs around the valley that might not be what you expect. Instead of calling a taxi or taking the bus, a lot of people just open an app, apps like Uber or Lyft. Today we hop in for a day on the job driving for Uber.
My name is Carl Long. I actually own a full-service travel agency, and I do Uber to kind of just break the monotony of my day.
My name's Blanca Aldana. I work for a medical office, and then I do Uber part-time after and on the weekends.
It was something that was easy for me to do, that it wasn't going to take too much of my time, and the best part of it is you're on your own schedule. That's the only reason why I started doing it at the beginning.
First thing I do is I log on to my app, which is on my cell phone, and once you go online, it shows anybody requesting an Uber ride that you're in the area. So if you're closest to that person, they put the request in, and I have 10 seconds to accept it. After that, if I accept it, I go to their location, pick them up. I don't know where they're going until I accept it, and then we just continue the ride until I finish it.
Never had any conflicts, never really been lost. I mean, it definitely helps being a native out here. The app really tells you exactly where to go from point A to point B, but you know, we can make suggestions of what we think would be a better route or a faster way. There is a gamble of where direction you're going when you're trying to end your day.
During the day, I'll try to do at least 5 hours. After work, I'll do maybe 2-3 hours, but you never know. You can't just cut it off, because there's been times where I've had to pick somebody up in downtown Phoenix and brought them all the way to South Chandler. So I can't say, oh, I'm going to be done at 7. Well, you can't really put a time on it, so.
I really get to just relax and just, it's like taking a long drive. And every now and then you just pick someone up and take them to a destination, but it definitely helps me clear my head. So I've learned to just have this as a good downtime, even though I'm working.
That's Carl Ong and Blanca Aldana, two Uber drivers living in the East Valley. We'll have more about somebody's job next Monday on the show. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.